The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
And I'm one of your other hosts, Jody Green from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
And I'm the last host.
Like an old prospector trying to claim his land.
Michael Scavarla with Penn State University.
And we are joined in our studio by a very special guest. Very special guest, would you please introduce yourself to the listeners?
Thanks for having me. My name is Ashley Kennedy. I'm a tick biologist for Delaware Mosquito Control, which is part of the Division of Fish and Wildlife for the state.
We appreciate having you on. It's awesome to see you in person as a human. I only know you as a cartoon character from Twitter thus far, so it's good to know that you are a real human.
Likewise. I feel like I know you guys from listening to this show, but this is the first time really seeing your faces.
Sorry about that.
Sorry about our faces, except for Mike. He's not a kid.
I don't even know anything about Delaware. I had to look it up on the map. It's so little.
Well,
we've gotten more attention, you know, the past year or so, thanks to President Biden than we normally do. Here in Delaware, everyone's familiar with the term Joe Jam, which refers to when the president is back in Wilmington and all, a bunch of the roads are closed and there's, you know, extra traffic because of the motorcade. So
I'm glad that you came up with a name for it.
Nice.
Is it exciting? Like, are you like, oh yeah, the president's here, so cool?
No.
Or is it just annoying?
It's just like, all right, I have to leave 15 minutes early to make my way around the Joe Jam.
Come on, president.
Small person.
It's the first state in the union.
Oh.
Yeah. They were the first one, right? Am I right?
That's right.
That's what I remember from the state quarter series that was in the early 2000s.
I'm sure that the Mint will be glad somebody learned something.
They taught me something. It was extension, technically. We appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and interview with you today. Jody, you put together a bit of an outline for us here today. So you want to kind of lead us off?
Yeah, but I always have to say that we have an outline, but it always goes kind of off the rails and we do side discussions and tangents, and that's okay too.
But it's a conversation. I mean, it's allowed to be organic.
Yeah. But I'm a huge Dr. Ashley fan, and I call you Dr. Ashley because that's who you are on Twitter. And I love following you because, well, I do love ticks and you're a tick biologist, but you have so many pockets of knowledge and so many other things. You love dogs. I love dogs. You talk about birds, I like birds, so many different things. And then your name came up when we were talking about Napoleon, of course. So Mike is very excited.
Right. I know he's a little daunted by trying to cram his extensive Napoleon knowledge base into a 15-minute presentation for upcoming Eastern Branch meeting. But I'm sure it will be phenomenal.
I'm pretty pumped. Maybe let's lead off on that. You're organizing a symposium for the Eastern Branch meeting, and you're really involved in the Ent Society of America. So do you want to talk about that a little bit? You know, we're all early career researchers, but I feel like you're maybe more involved with the society than the rest of us are.
Yeah. I didn't necessarily set out to get as involved as I am, but you keep showing up and people keep asking you to do more things, but I've found it very rewarding. So, you know, no regrets. You know, I kind of wandered into my first ESA meeting when I was a first year grad student at University of Delaware. And I had never been to a professional meeting of any kind, didn't know what to expect. It was a lot of fun. So after like dipping my toe in that first meeting, I just kept going back. And I've heard people say that everyone has like their one professional society that they adopt as their favorite. And so for me, it's ESA. I've gone to other societies meetings, but I have way more fun at ESA. I feel more connected to the people there. So it's the one that is on my list for, you know, I'm going to go every year one way or another, you know, by hook or by crook. May not have extensive travel funding, but I've got to find some way to get there because I really feel like I miss out if I don't make it.
I think it's the aggregation pheromone. It makes us all feel very comfortable when we're at ESA. Do you have any like fun stories from ESA? I know we've all been there as well. What's like a kind of highlight memory for you from the Entomology Society?
Sure. So one time I dressed up in a ridiculous blue bear costume, which was actually part of my official volunteer duties as a student volunteer. So ESA does offer like a partial registration offset like reimbursement if you volunteer as a student. So the year before Denver 2017, the meeting was held in Orlando in 2016. It was part of the ICE, the International Congress, and they needed someone to wear the blue bear costume, which is the, I guess, official, maybe unofficial mascot of Denver. And it was just to get people pumped up for that meeting. And right. So, you know, it was Orlando in September, and I was wearing this very heavy, like furry bear suit.
You got to simulate what it's like to work at Disney for a little
while. And I found that when you're wearing that costume, nobody can hear you, even if you're shouting. So I would see people I know and wave enthusiastically at them. And I'd be like, you know, hey, Justin, it's me, Ashley. And people just like get this creeped out look on their face and, you know, walk away leering at you.
It's a blue bear waving at you. It probably sounds like when you're yelling inside of it. Yeah.
I think I terrified a lot of people that day. I have a cool story like about like a networking success at ESA. I went to a meeting when I was like between my master's and PhD, and I was, you know, feeling kind of directionless and, you know, was looking for next steps for my career. And I knew I wanted to work on ticks, but I hadn't really gotten my foot in the door anywhere. And I, you know, recognized a speaker who's like a really top name in the field and just went up and introduced myself and told him I'd read some of his papers and wanted to work on ticks myself. And at that time, you know, I had zero past experience working on ticks, lots of experience being bitten by them, but that's it. And he was so kind and generous. He like, you know, took me under his wing and said like, oh, you want to work on ticks? Well, let me introduce you to so-and-so and so-and-so. And he just like took me around it. This is like at the reception in the exhibit hall, the, you know, maybe first or second night, and just introduced me to all these other people that, as far as I was concerned, were just like the hot shots of the tick world. And he made it sound like we were old buddies, and he was like enthusiastically recommending me to them. And, you know, he was just totally taking it on faith that I was serious about wanting to work on ticks. That's just one example of how welcoming the ESA community is. You know, that night didn't necessarily lead me to my next job or any of my jobs. It was just really good positive feedback as far as seeing how kind people were in the community and encouraging. And so it, you know, definitely gave me motivation to keep going to the meetings and keep trying.
I've had fairly like similar experiences, and I agree, like networking and seeing people that I either know in person or like know by reputation and going and introducing myself. That's, I think, one of the best parts of the meeting. Like, I like going to the talks and learning new stuff, but like the bits between the talks are like seeing somebody in the hallway, I think, is the best parts of the meeting. ESA is my favorite meeting in organization as well. You mentioned the blue bear costume. Looking through Jody's outline and notes, it also mentions another costume that you've worn.
Yes.
could you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. That was probably my favorite part of the most recent meeting. So I went to Denver again this year, and I was so excited to see that it overlapped with Halloween, which I know threw a wrench into a lot of people's schedules because, you know, there are people who had to miss out on the first day to be home trick-or-treating. So, you know, that is regrettable. I was looking forward to it because I love any excuse to wear a costume, and I thought this is the perfect opportunity to debut an arthropod costume. And I didn't have one planned. And then my sister just out of the blue texted me a photo of this amazing peacock spider costume. And she said, like, do you have any use for this? And I was like, let me tell you, I have the absolute perfect use for that. And I was like, are you seriously offering this? And she said her friend, Carrie Wickstead, had created it by hand and was looking for a new home for it. So my sister picked it up from her in Maryland, I think. And I coordinated to pick it up from my sister in DC. And then American Airlines managed to lose it en route to Denver. And so the really tragic thing was I didn't have it on Halloween, and I was really bummed out about it. And, you know, I kept telling everyone, especially if I saw someone in costume, I'd say, oh, I was going to wear my costume today, but it didn't come on time. So by the time American Airlines finally got it delivered to my hotel, it was November 3rd. So it was the last day of the conference. And I said, you know what? Like, I went through all the effort of bringing it here. I don't care if Halloween was 3 days ago. I'm just going to wear this around the exhibit hall for a couple hours. And I did. And again, was, you know, waving enthusiastically at people who didn't know who I was, you know, probably scaring a lot of people away. But I did get some good comments as well.
I like it. It's almost introducing a cosplay element to the Entomology Society meeting. I think that would be fun in the future.
Yeah. My husband was saying, like, you should do this every year, even if it doesn't overlap with Halloween at all. Just make this a yearly tradition.
I like that. Maybe we can volunteer Mike to join you. Maybe he'll wear a costume the next week. You can be a cat or something, Mike.
Okay. There is now you've got my attention.
There is nothing that made me have FOMO more than missing this year's meeting than seeing you in your costume dancing, because, you know, peacock spiders are jumping spiders that do that dance. And so it's not weird to have a dancing spider around. And that was amazing. Why did the person who design it in the first place? What was it used for originally?
I think she's just a naturalist who's a spider enthusiast. She's one of those people, I've never met her in person, but I'm kind of like shocked that the universe hasn't conspired to throw us together yet, because we have a lot of overlapping friends and interests. So I know she's an ornithologist and a herpetologist and an entomologist, kind of all rolled into one. So wow. I think she just made it for fun for Halloween. And then it does take up a lot of space. So, you know, that's why I had to ship it separately as its own checked piece of baggage. And then I arranged for a local ESA member to give it a third home after November 3rd. So it's up to her if she wants to bring it to a future ESA meeting. I figured I had my fun with it. It's time for it to move on.
It's like the spiderhood of the traveling costume. It's amazing. Can we put a photo of that in the show notes?
That'd be great. Yeah.
So going back to ESA, from what you're saying, if we were to say to students why you should join or participate in a professional meeting, you know, you've reaped all the benefits and you think it's worthwhile. Is that why you volunteer for a lot of the leadership opportunities?
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes it starts out as, you know, me just trying to build my CV a little bit, but it pays off in more than just, you know, professional development. I've met some of my best friends through ESA. So for me at this point, it's as much about like the social aspect and how much fun I have as much as it is about, you know, adding a line item to my CV. Mm-hmm. I've had some success in applying to awards for ESA, both like nominating myself and nominating peers and colleagues and professors. And I found that I've rarely been successful on the first try, but I have a much higher success rate on the second or third, you know, resubmission. And so I'm always telling people, like, if you weren't successful the first time, you know, you've already done the effort of putting together a nomination package, which can be onerous. You know, sometimes you've got to track down letters of recommendation. You have to compile, you know, lists of various achievements. So it can be, you know, it can take up a lot of time. But once you've already done it once, you know, don't let rejection the first year keep you from resubmitting it in the future. And the applicant pool can vary hugely from year to year. So it might have just been your bad luck that the first time you submitted it, you're up against like 10 super qualified people. And then, you know, the next year they might only get 3 or 4.
Maybe in the past, it wasn't so accepted that you should nominate yourself, or like that people would have the courage to do that. So I think that's really good that that's something that's promoted now.
Yeah. I think it doesn't hurt an application if it's a self-nomination rather than coming from a outside party.
That's some good advice. It sounds like we're sponsored by ESA today a little bit. Maybe we can hit them up for a commercial at some point in time in the future. At the start of the show, you guys were talking about the Twitterverse, and I am the poorest Twitterer of the Arthropod crew. And I know that you and Jody are connected on there. What is it about that platform that you enjoy for your SciComm communication sort of strategies? Like, what is it that drew you to using Twitter the most?
You know, I think when someone first suggested to me that I should use it, I went along with it, not expecting much to come out of it. And when I first joined, it was because I was a PhD student and I needed to crowdsource photos for my project. So I'll get into that later, but I was trying to collect photos of birds eating arthropods. And so I'd already created a Facebook page and a website and, you know, posted in various like print media, trying to solicit these kinds of photos from naturalists or, you know, from the public. And someone said, well, you need a Twitter account too. And at the time I'd never used Twitter and didn't know what to expect. So I created an account just for that purpose. But then I got really sucked in when I found all these cool people on there. So I, you know, over time that account morphed into my personal account that I still use, even though that project is done.
Right on.
Yeah. There's a lot of cool people that I've met on Twitter, and there's the whole phenomenon of, you know, finding out that some distinguished researcher that you really admire, you know, someone whose papers you've read and you only know their name from bylines, you know, finding their Twitter account and seeing that they're, you know, a real human being, you know, posting pictures of their puppy or what have you. So
they tried to make sourdough and failed and things like that. Yeah.
I think you answered my question, but I was going to ask if your Twitter had turned into like a SciComm Twitter, like where you only focus on science, or if it's more of a personal Twitter where you connect, you know, you put your own stuff on there, but also connect to other scientists that are either doing SciComm or personal, or, you know, what combination thereof.
Yeah, I guess my account is just sort of a hybrid of, yeah, all of the above. I do some SciComm, but some of it's just keeping in touch, sharing my life with friends. And I do try and post job opportunities and announcements, because I know that a lot of the people I'm connected with are other entomologists or other young researchers.
You mentioned with the Twitter that you were using that to crowdsource photos of birds eating arthropods for your PhD work. So, hey, let's talk about your PhD work. Can you give us kind of a brief outline of what you did and why you were needing those photos and what your project was, and we can go from there.
Sure. So I was in Doug Tallamy's lab at University of Delaware, and he's got quite a following from the general public, because he has some books that he's published that are, you know, meant for a wide audience. So his lab focuses on these food webs that involve, you know, plants, insects, and birds, kind of tying everything together. So, you know, tritrophic interactions. And he had this epiphany a while back that invasive plants are really bad news for birds. You know, it's not just that invasive plants come in and crowd out our native species. They're also, you know, not fulfilling the same suite of ecological services as the plants that they replace. So, you know, if you think about any given plant, it shares a long coevolutionary history with numerous insect species. And so when that plant disappears from the local ecosystem, you typically lose a lot of insects along with it, at least locally. And so he had various grad students investigating different parts of this process. So he had come up with the idea of crowdsourcing photos of birds eating arthropods, because if we could figure out which kinds of bugs are the most important in birds' diets, that would maybe shed some light on what we can be doing to manage our landscapes better for arthropod conservation and in turn for bird conservation. I had one component of my project where I set up camera traps at nest boxes for eastern bluebirds. So these camera traps recorded thousands of interactions, you know, parent bluebirds bringing various prey items back to the nest to feed their young. So I got like a really in-depth look at what eastern bluebirds are eating, at least, or what they're feeding their young during the breeding season in Delaware. So, you know, pretty narrow slice of the overall pie of bird insect interactions. So to kind of expand that to include other species, we did the crowdsourcing project. So we got photos in total, around 8,000 photos of several hundred different bird species. I want to say about 350 North American bird species, you know, bringing all sorts of arthropods back to feed their nestlings. And probably the most important take home from that was the role of caterpillars. So caterpillars, relative to other insect groups, they're just hugely important in bird diets, you know, by the numbers. So about 1 in 3 of the photos that were contributed from the public showed the birds with some kind of caterpillar prey. And it was around the same number that I found in my bluebird data set from the camera traps. It was about 40% caterpillars. And this is kind of a big deal because caterpillars, compared to other insect herbivores, they tend to be more host plant specialized. So, you know, if you've got something like a cricket or a grasshopper, they're typically happy eating, you know, a wide variety of vegetation, you know, different kinds of plant matter. But caterpillars tend to have these more tightly knit, you know, shared evolutionary history with a host plant. So there's kind of the famous example of monarchs on milkweed, but that's just one example. It's, you know, it's not the exception to the rule. It really is the rule. The figure I've heard is around 90% of caterpillars tend to be host plant specialized. So if, you know, now that we know that caterpillars are so important to birds, it's kind of alarming because it suggests that, you know, caterpillars would be more at risk of declines as landscapes become invaded by non-native plant species. And so that could in turn be a contributing factor into why so many bird species are declining as well. There's some pretty sobering statistics about that, at least for North America. Over the past 40 years, we've seen like a 50% decline in songbirds.
Why did you choose bluebirds?
For convenience is the short answer. And it's because they're cavity nesters. So they'll readily move into these man-made nest boxes. So it's easy to find their nests. You don't have to go like poking around in the woods, looking into trees. You can just go to where you already know there's a network of bluebird boxes set up. And then one thing that was convenient about them is they acclimated really readily to the cameras that I put up. You know, they weren't bothered by them at all. I put the cameras right on top of the nest box, and just within moments, the birds would return to the nest and resume their normal foraging activities. So I didn't have any guilt about, you know, disrupting their routine. They are insectivorous, especially during the breeding season. It was about 95% of their diet during the breeding season was arthropods.
Yeah. And I watched you have a YouTube video of your research, which was really cool. They're really cute. So the boxes were already there when you set things up. You didn't set the boxes up and invite the birds.
That's right.
I don't know if you listened to our last podcast with David Coyle, but he was talking about calorie repair and the invasive species.
And he even mentioned like the sheer number of caterpillars that a single brood of Carolina chickadees need to rear one clutch to fledging. So I've heard, yeah, it's between 6,000 and 9,000 caterpillars just to take a clutch of four chicks and rear them just to the age where they're able to leave the nest. And they continue needing to eat caterpillars after that time too. So when he described invaded landscapes as food deserts for birds, I mean, that's so true. I couldn't put it any better than that.
So what I'm hearing is some of these biocontrol agents that we need to bring in for calorie repair and privet and Japanese honeysuckle and things, we really need to go find caterpillars that feed on them. Then the birds will eat them.
I don't know if that's the best route, but
it was a little tongue in cheek. I did want to ask though, so how hard was it to identify these prey things? Like, are they coming in with like, it's obviously a caterpillar draped out of the beak and you can identify it to like species, or is it like a masticated ball of, well, that was an insect at some point?
It was all over the place. The quality was highly variable, you know, based on all kinds of factors. You know, if it was, you know, too dark outside, or if the insect prey is too small and the bill obscures too much of it, but over 90% could be identified at least to order. So most prey were only identified to order. And then a subset of about one third were identified to family. And then, you know, about 14% we got to species.
That's still really impressive.
I mean, and that's not, you know, corroborated by DNA or anything. That's just, you know, something that we felt comfortable enough to put a species name on it. We could be wrong. But sometimes the photos were very clear. You got a nice close shot of the prey, sometimes from multiple angles. And so you would really be able to see those diagnostic features. I swear that it's almost like the bluebirds knew what the goal of the project was, because they were such photogenic models for me. I mean, they would, you know, land on the nest box in front of the camera. We've got, you know, some caterpillar hanging out of their bill, and then they like turn their head 90 degrees so I get another shot of it. and they stay there and like sit really still so I get multiple shots of it. So they're very cooperative. And I say that because I also tried to do the same thing with house wrens, and it was the other end of the spectrum where the house wrens were moving too quickly. So all the photos came out blurry. And sometimes instead of landing on the roof of their nest box, they just fly directly into the nest hole. So I don't get to see the prey at all. And they're so much smaller than bluebirds. And so they go after smaller insect prey too. So it was pretty rare that I got a shot of a house wren with prey that I could identify to species.
I mean, it's incredible and really lucky that like you picked bluebirds and it just happened. Like they were so good and big enough that you're getting bigger prey. Like, cause I can imagine like if you went out thinking in the beginning, like we're going to focus on house wrens, like that's what I want to look at. And, you know, halfway through the project, it's, oh shoot, they're all too small and they fly right into the nest box. This is bad. We got to change. It sounds really lucky, but also, I mean, that happens, I guess, a lot in research that you just stumble upon it and it works out really well. Like it sounds like it did.
I was jumping up and like literally shouting in my office the first time that I like connected my GoPro to my computer and saw that it had worked and I got good shots because I really didn't know if it was going to work. You know, and I mentioned it, I use GoPros as my cameras. So those are not trail cameras. They're not, you know, camera traps that are motion activated. A real motion activated camera trap was out of budget for me. So, so the GoPro, I wasn't sure if it was going to work because it can be set to take photos on a time lapse. So I just set it to take one photo every second. So the whole time the camera is deployed, it's taking just, you know, thousands of photos. And most of them are not useful because they're not actually showing a bird with the prey. But even after deleting all those photos that were not helpful, at the end of three field seasons, I had photos of over 8,000 prey items, which is from across 38 different broods. So 38 pairs of bluebirds bringing food back to their young.
How many did you get from the public then, images? Because I thought you said it was a similar number. Is that?
Yes, it was a very similar number.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
That's really impressive that you got that many just from the public too. Like that you got that kind of response from just putting a call out saying, we want these photographs. Can you send them in?
Yeah, it was really cool to see the photos coming into the website or to the Facebook page. I mean, that was my favorite part of this project. You know, some of those photographers were way more talented than I am. You know, some of them got really amazing shots that should be on the covers of magazines. And of course, you know, they captured way more bird diversity and geographic diversity than I was able to get. You know, I was just focusing on my bluebirds in Delaware. But because of this project, I got to see like, oh, so here's what a greater roadrunner eats out in the desert. And here's what burrowing owls eat in Florida, you know, mangrove cuckoos, just all kinds of birds that I've never seen firsthand.
Are you a birder? Do you like watching the birds?
So I had a lab mate when I was in Doug Tallamy's lab, Desiree Narengo, who's phenomenal. I mean, if you haven't seen any of her work, you got to look her up because she's brilliant. And she started about a year or two ahead of me. So we overlapped, but she liked to describe herself as the ornithologist who wound up working on insects by accident. And I was like the entomologist who wound up working on birds by accident. So I definitely,
it was a natural crossover.
Yeah. I identify as an entomologist and got to learn a lot about birds during this project, but I'm still, you know, kind of a rookie birder.
Awesome. I am interested. I mean, I've heard of Doug Tallamy. I'm guessing Jody and Mike have as well, to work in his lab as a PhD student. I would imagine that's a pretty cool experience. I remember I heard him give a little talk once. I was in DC working at the Smithsonian and Alma Solis took me to this. It was like a lunch club. And he was talking there, I think, about one of the books that he had written. It may have been right around 07. So I think that was when his first book came out, or one of his first books came out. And, he's just so into native species and native conservation and everything. This might be a slightly controversial tangent to take. It is off script. It is off of our outline. So we can table it if you want. But have you seen, this has been floating around a little bit. There was an article from Vox earlier this week. Maybe the other two have seen it. It's titled, "It's Time to Stop Demonizing, Quote, Invasive Species." Mm. And it's pretty much all about how we shouldn't use that term, that it's nativist and reductive, and that it It frames things that may be moving as a result of climate change or as of our own fault as evil intruders. It's militaristic and imperialistic. There was a lot of talk about this, and I thought it was a very thought-provoking article, and we can maybe, if we can have a discussion, we could put it in the show notes for people to read. But I didn't know, coming from Ptolemy's lab, I mean, what's your gut reaction to hearing some of that kind of discussion?
I haven't read that piece yet, but my gut reaction is, I mean, I'm ready to take a pretty hard line against plants that did not evolve, where they are now. And of course, it's not any given organism's fault if it winds up somewhere through anthropogenic means, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't eradicate it if we can. And I even think people are too gentle when trying to delineate between, what is invasive versus merely exotic or non-native. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if it doesn't have an evolutionary history in the area where it is now, its space could be better occupied by native species.
I think that's interesting. And I mean, it's kind of some of the stuff that I was thinking about. They talk about how the term invasive, some of its history is it comes from this executive order from Bill Clinton. They even interview Cimberloff in this article and ask for their input on this whole thing. And they talk about one of the reasons I was interested in the article is we just talked to Dr. David Coyle on the last episode about eradication efforts for Asian longhorn beetles. And in this article, they're really hard, I think, on eradication efforts, particularly for vertebrate species. They hit really hard on the fact that we tried to poison starlings, and that was a disaster, it seemed like, in their opinion. So I was just curious, as a Ptolemyan, how you would react to hearing somebody say invasive species is a harmful word. I mean, words are important. I'm all about having those kinds of conversations if we need to, but I don't know if I can forgive Japanese beetles for being Japanese beetles, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I know at this point it's moot to even talk about eradication because it's impossible in so many situations, but wherever we can replace non-natives with natives, I think we should strive for that. And I'll mention my colleague Desiree again, because she was an author on a really cool paper out of the Ptolemy lab that basically found this magic number of 70%. If you can get your yard to be about 70% native plants, it becomes a really productive bird habitat. So that gives people some leeway. Like if you have some ornamental exotic plant that you don't want to remove either for sentimental reasons, or you think it looks pretty, or it would just be a pain to get rid of it, it gives you some wiggle room there where you can have up to 30% exotic. But if it's any more than that, then your birds are really going to be struggling to find enough insect protein to rear their young. And wow. She did the study in the DC area with Carolina chickadees and was basically measuring, how far these chickadee parents had to go to forage. And if they have to go too far, their nest success goes way down. If they've got to be going across, five different yards to find insect protein, they're going to be exhausted.
Are they going to places that are more native? Like, do we see that sort of directed travel?
Yeah. Breeding success is higher where there's a higher percentage of native plants and in turn, more caterpillars and more insect biomass.
So many levels to landscaping that we don't always consider when we're going out and planting. Yeah. I'm going to go home and look at my yard, but I think it's mostly honeysuckle in the back right now. So maybe blackberries as well. Probably not a good example.
Well, I think what's really empowering about this whole avenue of research is like it gives everybody something that they can do to help conservation because, so many problems facing wildlife today seem just too challenging. Like they're out of our hands. If you're not a very powerful decision maker, how much impact can you have really? Or at least that's the mindset that a lot of people seem to have. But this is something like if you have even a little patch of land, either that you own or that you have influence over in some other way. I mean, if you live in an apartment, maybe you can influence what a local park is planting, for example. It's a real tangible way that you could have an impact. And it's manageable because, just start with one plant at a time, get this one Bradford pear out of here and get, a white oak in its place. And that's a really meaningful contribution.
I like that a lot. I think that's really important. It's important for us as scientists and science communicators to find those things. Cause it is hard to talk to people. Like I talk to people about climate change and impacts on insects. And I mean, what can I, they're not the U.S. Army. They're not going to stop some of the biggest emissions that we're producing in the country, but something that they can get their hands on and do like this, I think is a really cool project that must have been really fun to be a part of.
Yeah, it's awesome to see, like, sometimes you'll just be talking to someone and you see like the recognition in their eyes when they realize like, oh, my yard could be so much more than just like a, you know, a pretty yard with flowers in it. It could actually be like wildlife habitat if I just make a few key changes to it. And so I think that's why Doug Tallamy's books have really taken off. He's found a very receptive audience from people who, you know, realize that gardening doesn't just have to be a hobby. It doesn't have to be just purely for aesthetic value. It can, you know, be a real game changer in conservation.
Talking about oaks this, you know, spring and summer more than ever. And I have an oak tree in my backyard that produces like just mass production of acorns, and they spread up all through the yard. This year, one of my goals was to harvest those and give them out. So I probably gave away probably about 30 or 35 oak trees to different cool. people, to master gardeners. To anyone who had like farm or any place, that was what I gave as gifts, because they would start growing. They'd be about this high. And then I'd dig them up, put them in containers. So that alone is a huge impact from Doug Tallamy and people wanting to do something for the earth and mm-hmm. like, you know, the connections in the landscape. So.
And a part of that process of, you know, educating the public about this is, you know, teaching people that it's okay if bugs are eating your plants. you know, I think there's like a whole generation of people who just automatically reach for, you know, the spray can if they see that something's eating their plant. And so, you know, you try and reach those people and say like, oh, it's okay. Like your plant is doing its job in the ecosystem. You know, it's supposed to feed the insects so that the insects can feed the birds. And I did not come up with this, so I can't take credit for it, but I heard about like the 10-step program for assessing insect herbivory. And so if you notice that an insect has been chomping on some leaves on your plant and it looks really bad close up, so take 10 steps back. Does it still look bad from that distance? And usually at that distance, it doesn't. It still looks like a big leafy green tree or what have you. So if that's the case, you don't have to do anything. Just like let that. Nature unfold.
I thought you were going to lay out 10 specific steps of things to do.
I know, that's why it's so great. I won't know who to cite either, but I will tell people that as well. And I think, you know, when you mentioned caterpillars as being one of the top food sources, caterpillars are one of the top plant pests because that's what they feed on. And it's something that I have to repeat over and over again when people are wondering like where their butterflies are, or, you know, these moths, they're not doing anything. But as larvae, they are going to be a little bit pesty because they feed on plants. So you can't have these beautiful adults if you're not going to deal with a little bit of damage. And, you know, mm-hmm. people who that don't necessarily appreciate arthropods as much as we do, it's like, what's their purpose? And it's like, well, this is like what you were saying, this is their purpose, and they are fulfilling that need. So
definitely.
The project that you're laying out is very conservation minded, very focused on an interaction between these vertebrates and between caterpillars. And you're a tick biologist now. So where was the gear shift there? Like, how did you go from what sounds like a very ecological world to more of a pest control type world and a medical and veterinary type pest world?
Well, they're not as diametrically opposed at first brush. From a medical entomologist perspective, my goal is to, you know, educate people about ticks and other vectors so that, you know, the more you know about these arthropod enemies, the more prepared you are to, you know, they become less scary, basically. So, you know, I don't want people to be so frightened of ticks and mosquitoes that they never leave their house, because then we'll have, you know, whole generations of people who won't care about conservation and won't care about nature because they're not exposed to it. You know, there's also this growing body of literature supporting the idea that tick-borne disease infection rates go up, you know, the more we disturb the environment. So really, if we want to protect public health, that ties right in with protecting environmental health. So a lot of ticks and their most important the most important reservoir hosts for tick-borne pathogens. They really flourish in these fragmented ecosystems where, you know, what once was a great forest is like chopped up into many different like subdivisions with just little patches of trees. So if we can, you know, preserve more contiguous habitat and connect habitats, you know, with various like wildlife corridors, that could possibly play a role in reducing our likelihood of coming into contact with a pathogen carrying tick.
I think that is all. Yeah. I mean, that's stuff that we try to talk about. I do a little bit of tick education here at Kentucky. I work with a graduate student here. Maybe your paths will cross in the future or have before, Anna Pasternak. She's leading our statewide survey and doing a lot of really cool work with it. I don't want to dive too much into tick biology and tick maintenance or anything. I was just curious how you got from birds and caterpillars, I guess, to ticks. I mean, it like you said, it's not diametrically opposed, but it seems like a kind of a gear shift to me.
I guess my interests have always been kind of all over the place. I guess like when it comes to entomology, like everything is interesting to me. So I didn't know I was, you know, destined to become a tick biologist. But ticks were probably one of the first arthropods that really got my attention because I first got Lyme disease when I was 3 years old. So yeah, I have memories of being a very small child and like pulling ticks off myself.
Holy cow. Yeah. That would be a foundational memory, I imagine.
Yeah. But when I was in college and before that, even in high school, I had kind of this vague idea of being, you know, a wildlife biologist. And I saw myself maybe on like the plains of Africa, radio collaring elephants or something really exciting, you know, working with charismatic megafauna. So that was what drew me into the natural sciences as a broad field. And then it was just kind of by luck that luck might be a funny word for it, but when I was graduating from college, it was, you know, middle of an economic recession, jobs were hard to come by. So, and I was so desperate to work with wildlife. So I got to a point where I was just applying for every vacancy that popped up on the Texas A&M job board. It's like a wildlife focused job board. And University of Delaware first popped up on my radar because they have a department of entomology and wildlife ecology. As far as I know, it's the only department that combines those two fields, those two disciplines into one department. And so when I first started applying for positions there, I was more hoping I would get one of the positions working with, like, you know, river otters or snow leopards or something. The first positive response I got to any of these literally dozens of job applications I threw out into the abyss was from Charles Bartlett, who's a Delphacid planthopper taxonomist at University of Delaware. And when he reached out to me, I could not have told you what a planthopper was. I wasn't even really clear on what taxonomy was, but I was just so excited to get a call back. So I, you know, just dived in head first. And so I made sure that by the time I showed up, I had done a lot of reading on planthoppers and probably still managed to embarrass myself quite a bit because I showed up to grad school not ever having taken a class in entomology because we didn't have any entomology classes at my undergrad college. So yeah, that was a gear shift. And, you know, it wasn't the elephants that I dreamed of working on.
The hoppers are a little different than the big elephants.
1 or 2 millimeters long.
You know? Yeah. That's interesting. It's a very intriguing path to take, I think. Yeah. And then to start out in taxonomy, you said the T word. So Mike is going to probably chime in here, but.
I did. You saw the mute go off.
I did.
I just wanted to ask, do you find that you're not like a taxonomist per se now, but do you find that having taxonomic training just in anything in a different group than what you're working on, is it helpful? Does that translate into useful ways into like what you did in your PhD with the birds and what you're doing now with ticks?
Definitely. Yeah. So my PhD, even though it was more of an ecological project, it did involve, you know, identifying all those thousands of insect prey items, which I was only able to do because I had by then taken several courses in arthropod identification and taxonomy. So, to me, identification and taxonomy just go hand in hand. I found taxonomy to be very interesting, and it's more exciting if you're an entomologist than probably working with any other kind of animals, because there's just so many more waiting to be described. So as a lowly master's student, I got to describe several new species, even several new genera. And, you know, you can't really do that these days with birds or mammals, or at least it's a lot harder to find material to describe in those groups. So it made me realize just how little we know about insects and how there's just so much more scope for future discoveries with insects compared to the other groups. So by the time I graduated with my master's, I was, you know, diehard entomologist. So, you know, I knew that the elephants were just not meant to be.
But now you work on parasites. So, like, you could work on the parasites of elephants.
That would be very cool. Maybe someday.
My master's and PhD advisor, so I didn't switch labs between the two. That was his tact. He was a mammalogist at heart, but early on decided he didn't want to work on just one mammal. He wanted to work on a bunch. And so, you know, there's not really mammalogy programs where you can do that. You typically focus on one or just a few species. And that's the whole reason he went into entomology and parasitology and within entomology, because then he got to work on all kinds of different mammals.
Yeah. I have a colleague at Delaware Mosquito Control named Sierra, who just started working for us this past summer. And she was kind of like me, where she started out being more excited by the megafauna. But I told her, like, well, if you're willing to work on ticks with me, like, we can come up with some way to tie that in with your interest. And she piloted this really cool study on collecting ectoparasites off of roadkill in Delaware. And it's just been, it's been very gruesome, very gory, but she got into it, didn't mind getting her hands dirty. And she, you know, technically she got to work with, you know, red foxes and raccoons and opossums and white-tailed deer and all kinds of other mammals.
Work with implies a certain level of movement that I imagine was lacking in the partnership.
Fair enough. But she's been like such a good sport about it. And I think she'll be an entomologist by the time I'm done with her.
That sounds like a future podcast guest to me. Somebody that could tell us about their roadkill entomology project personally.
I've always wanted to do a roadkill entomology project. So I heartily second that.
Mike, didn't you once want, I thought I was told once that you wanted me to like send you any dead hawks or something I saw on the side of the road. You wanted to put them in Berlazy funnels or something, right?
I mean, that sounds like a thing I would ask.
That sounds like a thing you would say to me, yeah.
What kind of dead things were you supposed to collect?
Hawks. I think it was hawks.
Oh, dead hawks.
Probably looking for bird kids. I was looking at roadkill armadillos in Arkansas when I was there, because it turns out my boss was collaborating with somebody working on eyebrow, the mites in your eyebrows, Demodex. And it turns out that armadillos has a very weird Demodex species, and we were trying to get them, and they're around the face. So I was decapitating armadillos that were roadkill and sending them on dry ice in the mail.
I might have a ked for you off a hawk from Delaware. I'll be in touch.
Yes, please. I'll from you and for all of the listeners, if you have keds, I will take them.
You got it.
Ashley, I was going to send you an email after, but I guess we could ask, since we're kind of a little bit all over the place right now. When, and I apologize, I cannot remember her name. Did she find any keds on the deer that she looked at? Do you know?
We have not found any keds. And I've read, you know, the papers that have come out of Penn State about collecting keds and ticks off of deer. And so I keep getting my hopes up that we'll find one, but it's been only ticks so far off of our deer.
But that's really interesting. We found that they peter out in southeastern Pennsylvania. In 200 deer that we've looked at in the southeast, we found one kid on one deer.
Wow.
Even though they're super abundant, like here and up north. Do you know Jennifer Mullineaux? Okay. She works, I think, in Maryland. And she was looking for kids there, and they're not in eastern Maryland. So I think they just peter out. I'm not sure you'll find any in Delaware, which is why I was asking, like, if you did find them, that would be really cool.
I'll let you know if I do.
Yeah, please keep a lookout, because if you find them, that's going to be different and interesting.
Actually, I was curious, even before your master's, you worked with wildlife, and it seemed like you did something really cool. You worked with like monkeys?
Sure. I worked with vervet monkeys. So yeah, if you had asked me at that time, you know, before my entomologist days, yeah, I wanted to be basically like the next Jane Goodall. So I did a summer at the Vervet Monkey Foundation, which is in Zanine, South Africa. it's a nonprofit organization where they rescue mostly orphaned vervet monkeys. Vervet monkeys are classified as a pest in South Africa, so farmers often kill them, or they meet with an accidental death through, you know, electrocution or poisoning or what have you. My study, which was basically trying to figure out, like, what happens if you put a bunch of unrelated baby vervet monkeys together, which is what happens in this setting, what sort of dominance hierarchy will form? Because in their social groups that they're born into, they have a very strict social hierarchy, and it's determined, you know, by the mother. So the infant monkey will, you know, sort of adopt the same role in the hierarchy as their own mother. So, you know, I wanted to know if you don't have that background, you know, what happens when you're just throwing a bunch of monkeys that don't know each other together? And from what I could tell, it was mostly determined by size and age. So the older, bigger baby monkeys dominated the younger ones. So they, you know, would take food away from them, would take milk bottles away from them, would take the prime perching spots and so forth. And I'm not going to be sending that paper out to anyone because it would not hold up to peer review. But it was a fun project. I did get to work hands-on with vervet monkeys, and that was a long time ago.
That's definitely a brand new sentence for Arthropod to hear somebody say, throw all these unrelated monkeys together in a room. I don't think we've ever had that brought up before, so we appreciate it. We also appreciate your time to be a part of the show here today. It was great to learn about your PhD project, get to know you here in real life in person, hear about your ESA experiences and everything. So thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Is there anything that we can help promote, your Twitter, if you want to put that out there, or any online projects that people can find for you?
Sure. If anyone wants to get in touch, my Twitter handle is DETikTok. And so that's spelled as though we're talking about ticks, the arthropods, you know. DE being short for Delaware. That's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me.
Awesome. So hopefully people will find you there. If they've got ticks, maybe they can talk to you about them or ask you some questions. Hopefully they keep it localized to Delaware. I'm not going to start sending Kentucky people your way, so don't worry about that. But I'm at Bugman John.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And I'm at mscabarla36.
We appreciate everybody that listened to the show. Thank you for tuning in. If you want to find Arthropod on the web, we are arthro-pod.blogspot.com. That is us. You can always find our show notes there and check out all of that information that we post with each episode. We are also on all of your favorite podcatcher apps. We're on Stitcher. We're on Spotify. We are on Apple Podcasts. We are arthro-pod on all of those, though. You must include the dash, for if you don't, you will not find us. We have recently had some folks that have contacted us. They said that they wanted to financially support the show. I think that this was in regards to our lamentations about being, I think, as Mike called it, funded by bubblegum and spirit or something like that on our 100th episode. We are not accepting donations. We do not need financial help with the show. We appreciate the folks that want to do that. We are just extension entomologists. We don't want to have our universities take half of your donation as grant funding or anything. So if you want to support somebody, we, the three of us, would highly encourage you to find EntoPOC and to donate to that group. Right, Jody?
Right. Their website is entopoc.org, and you can find them at Twitter. But there are places you can donate, and it really helps people of color become members of entomological societies that we have talked about today. So it's very important, and we three strongly believe in this organization.
So we hope that if you do have some extra money that you want to chip away to a good cause, that you will take advantage of them and their donation links.
We should say also, if anybody has us in their Spotify Wrapped for 2021 because is their favorite podcast.
Oh,
please let us know.
Yeah.
If we're number one podcast on Spotify, drop us a line.
Yeah. Take a screenshot. I would love to see that. That actually would make my day to see us in a Spotify Wrapped. So yes, please do take a screen grab and let us see that. Thanks for sticking with us. And we will catch you on the next episode of Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
My dog managed to get in. I had the door closed, but he managed to get in, and he's weirdly gotten really horny in his old age.
Okay.
So he was kind of humping my leg a little bit under the table while I'm giving this talk, and I'm trying to push his face away from me, and he's a Great Pyrenees, so he's a very large dog, so
gotcha.
You couldn't tell what was happening, luckily, on screen, but
right.
Something was happening, and it was very
something is amiss.
I mean, that's at the low bar for as far as Zoom presentations being derailed for me.
Nice.